Do your rights come from God, or are they the result of, quote-unquote, the highest human achievement? Next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis, and I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and normally I'm the co-host of the Institute for Principled Policy's Principles and Policies show. Today, I am the host, just because we're doing things a little differently today. Everybody's a little busy, and we don't have time. We found ourselves at doing things like fundraisers for other ministries and doing taxes and getting mailings prepared for things, and we just ran out of time this week. So what we're going to do is we're going to have me put on my hat as the executive director of Camp American. Now, we've talked about Camp American on this program on several different occasions, and we're going to talk about it again because right now we're in our registration period. And we're trying to get people to be interested in coming up to Camp American and possibly bringing their children who they want to have trained in a comprehensive Christian worldview and how to apply that worldview to all of life. And in order to do that, we're going to give you a sample of a class. Now, obviously, this class was given, and it has visual aspects, and there is actually a video available of this, but we can't show you that on the radio. So I'm going to put on my Camp American director hat, and we're going to talk about this class that Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center, and that's www.americanpolicy.com. Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center taught this class in, I believe, 2010. And the subject of this class is the discussion of where rights come from. Now, we've talked about this very early in this program series. Barry Sheets and I discussed rights and where they come from and what the purpose of government is, but Tom's going to lay it out for you. We did it over a week. Tom's going to put it in a nutshell for you. He's going to get the job done in about 50 minutes. Tom does an excellent job of laying out the reasons why we have to have a comprehensive Christian worldview. Now, he doesn't say that per se, but this is the whole point. If we don't understand that the origin of our rights is from God, and we think it comes from government, there are logical implications that go along with that way of thinking. And one of those logical implications is the idea that if government can give us rights, then government can take them away. Well, you can think the same thing from a Christian worldview, except that if God gives you rights, then God can take them away. But since God is immutable and unchanging, then we have rights because God has given them, and we have no fear that he will ever take them away. Does that mean that government or someone connected with government may not at some point try to squelch those rights? Well, no, that's equally a bad way of thinking about these things. But the fact is that since we have these rights, it is the duty of government not to give them to us, but to protect them. And that is a vast difference of the way of thinking about government than the way the world thinks about government, the secular world. We have people talking in terms of finding quote-unquote new rights or giving certain rights in the Constitution that we've never had before. Well, the Constitution does not give rights. The Constitution guarantees rights, and you can see that notion laid out specifically in, for instance, the 9th and 10th Amendments, especially the 9th, which essentially says, and I will quote it to you so I don't get it wrong, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." In other words, that word "retained" has a special meaning. It says we have them, we're keeping them, and the fact that we didn't name them specifically in this document doesn't mean that we don't have them and we aren't keeping them. It does not give the federal government, the state governments, local governments carte blanche to come in and take those rights away from us. Okay, I think I've blathered on long enough. I think you need to hear Tom give the explanation. So, without further ado, here's Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center at Camp American. And again, if you're interested in what you hear, please contact us at www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com. And register for classes. We are now, the registration is open. You can register online. There is an online form that you have to fill out, but you can make your deposit now, and we're asking you, please sign up and send in your deposit right now. That's www.campamerican.com. Here's Tom DeWeese.
All right. How many left-handers do I have here? All of your hands. Oh, man. Left-handers. Left-handers. You guys all are special. Left-handers are going to take over the world, and you need to learn to listen through the other ear for what we have to say. I have no idea what any of that meant. I said it last night that we are doing what we're doing because we want to preserve this country and the freedoms that we have for you. And we want to make it so that you are able to have a voice and defend what we believe in. And I know everything that Chuck told you is long and lots of detail and so forth, but you know what? You guys are some of the only people in this country now who know that information. And that's very important because there are forces loose who are trying to change this country in such horrible ways. And in spite of all the backroom dealing and the subterfuge and so forth that was gone through to create the Constitution of the United States, the miracle of it, and there's a book called The Miracle of Philadelphia, the miracle of it is that they created what is really today the greatest document for the governance of man ever created. And it may not be perfect, and it certainly could be, there could be chances to repair it, and there could be ways to do that, but it still is the best ever. And we are dedicated, our lives are dedicated to preserving it. Our founding fathers feared government, even the one they were creating. And that's why they put all these things in it, to try to block this from happening and block that from happening. And they wanted to protect us. The Constitution very clearly says this is the power of the federal government, and then the rest of the power goes to the states. That's what the 10th Amendment's about. Everything, if it doesn't say it specifically in the Constitution, and it's not supposed to be a power of the federal government, it's supposed to be in the states. The idea is that the closer government gets to you, the more power it should have. That way, if your local county commissioners or city councilmen try to do things that you don't like, rather than being like a congressman in Washington and try to find him there and talk to him, which is nearly impossible, the county commissioner comes into your restaurant or walks down the street or whatever, and if you grab him by the throat and say, I hate this, I'm going to do this. And he, knowing that you're there, that you are going to be the, if he does something you don't like, you're going to be able to get right to him. He's going to think twice before he does it. And that's the power, the way the government should be. We've turned it around, and the federal government becoming the most powerful, and that's where the problem comes from. It's interesting. There are now two forces in the world on the ideas of government. And those ideas are represented in these two documents. The Declaration of Independence, which goes hand in hand with the Constitution. I know that some of the textbooks that are used in schools today will just say that the Declaration of Independence is just a political document. It was just a petition that was sent to the king of our grievances, and that's all that is. What the Declaration of Independence does is lay down the principles of American freedom. It lays down what we believe in and what should be the guide to how we are governed. The Constitution, then, is the how-to. It's the blueprint. It's the instruction manual. Here's how it's to be done. And so those two documents go together, hand in hand. You cannot separate them. The Constitution basically would make no sense if you don't have the Declaration of Independence there with it, telling, well, this is what we mean. The other document in the world is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from the United Nations. These are the two documents competing for the ideas of people in this country and in the world. Here's the difference. The Declaration of Independence says we hold these truths to be self-evident. There's no question. We have these rights. We are born with these rights. God gave us these rights, and nobody can take those away from us. And government's job is to protect those rights. The Constitution is written very specifically to say that government doesn't give you your rights. Government protects your rights. The Universal Declaration on Human Rights, however, says this Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaims this General Assembly, the United Nations, proclaims this Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a common standard of achievement. It sounds like this gibberish, and that's what it is. The other thing is, where the Declaration of Independence says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that you have these rights no matter what, the Declaration of Human Rights says these rights and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations, of men, of law. Now, this is the battle that's going on in the world. And the interesting thing about it is, if you look in your textbooks, you will find a discussion on positive versus negative rights. Now, which one would you consider to be the more appealing, positive or negative? Anybody? Yeah. I know you know, Chuck. What would you say? Positive or negative? Which is the more appealing? Nobody knows? Well, let me put it this way. Your textbooks will say the Constitution of the United States starts out, government shall not. That's a negative right. That means that the... Yeah. Well, what the line, government shall not, means that government is controlled. Government's controlled by the people. Government shall not expand its power. Government shall not tell you what your rights are going to be. That's what that means. It's a control of government by the people. Those who are promoting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights consider that a negative right. Or a negative power. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights says government shall. That is the rule of man, where man is deciding what your rights will be. It's saying that today, with this gang of thugs in charge, we're going to tell you today these are your rights. Now tomorrow there may be a new gang of thugs. And they say, no, you don't have those rights. These are your rights. And you're reeling back and forth. What does this stupid thing say up here? That, you know, that we'll do it with fairness and we'll have a big group hug and we'll say kumbaya and all this. But they're telling you every day a new set of rules. The Declaration of Independence says these are unquestionable. We hold these truths to be self-evident. I mean, you have to be a moron to question them. It's self-evident. That's what they're teaching today in school. Positive rights. Every other form of government, every other country in this world is based on the Declaration of Human Rights, based on positive rights. Only the United States is based on negative rights. All the democracies that grew out of when the Soviet Union fell, when the Iron Curtain fell, they created all these new democracies, social democracies. They're all based on the idea that government will tell you what to do. So that's that. Now, and I think the way to sum that up, it was John Locke that said, you don't have, your rights don't exist because of government. Government exists because you have rights. You have rights to protect, or you have government to protect your rights. You don't put government together to say, here's what your rights will be. Now, this is what we're trying to preserve, we're trying to save, is this way of life, this idea that you are born with your rights. And there is a massive movement in the world to change that. Why? Because people get power from it. There's no power to be gained from a government that is controlled. There's no money to be made from it. Corporations can't get rich off of it. The more power government gets, the more rich and the more powerful certain elements get, and the more oppressed everybody else gets. So we're trying to defend that. Now, there are those who believe, rightfully so, that the Constitution and the way the government has been going is in the wrong direction. Government's getting bigger by the day, and they're very concerned about this. Watching what happened September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, going on to June, July of this year, massive spending by the federal government, massive, massive power grabs. You know, the President of the United States becomes the chairman of the board of GM. This is unprecedented, and it frightens people, should frighten people. And so there has been a movement to grab back control. And the way they want to do that is by a constitutional convention. The Article 5 of the Constitution says, the Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments. And, you know, they want to make changes. Some people really frightened. They want to shore it up. They want to make sure the Constitution isn't changed. Or is not usurped, and so they think if we put a little shoring up here, a little wall over here, then we can prevent that. And some of the states are calling for the Constitutional Convention, particularly on the issue of the balanced budget, because they're watching all the spending that's going on in Washington, massive amounts of spending, and these are the people calling for this are not crazed left wing radicals. They're Republicans. They're conservatives. They're concerned. And they want to call a convention for a balanced budget. Now, I got a call. When was that? December?
December.
Yeah. I was just at home in peace. And about 8 o'clock, Chuck calls me. It's meant to be that way. And Chuck said, have you heard? What's about to happen in Ohio? No. He said, there's a resolution put out by, he mentioned several state legislators' names, one of whom particularly I knew him to be a very good man. And he said, they're calling for Ohio to put in a resolution for a constitutional convention. And I said, okay. He said, no, you don't understand. They wanted to call it for a balanced budget amendment. There have already been 32 states that have called for a balanced budget amendment or a constitutional convention to call for a balanced budget. He said, if Ohio does it, it'll be 32 or 33, and we only need 34. And the whole mechanism goes into place. And he spent a great deal of time explaining to me why this was not a good idea. And he said, there's a hearing tomorrow. We have 18 hours to organize. 18 hours. So he and I split duties. He put together, what, was 10 people to come and testify?
Yeah, I didn't actually do that. What I did was I contacted a guy named Robert Owens, who had a few more grassroots contacts than I did. He contacted other grassroots groups. And I think we got 10 or 12.
It was 10, yeah. Well, the point of the matter is you started this thing in motion and got it going. Well, he was doing that, getting ready. Now, here are these guys. Here was the plan. They had, as Chuck was talking about, when they put the first constitutional convention together. They already had a document that they were going, a constitution they were planning to put into place. They already knew what they wanted it to do. You don't do these things just off the cuff and say, let's see what happens. You plan. Well, their plan was they were going to put in this resolution. They weren't even going to hold hearings, I don't think, originally. They were going to put in this resolution and just vote on it. It was on the calendar for the legislature to vote on it the next day. And it was a done deal. There was no question this thing was going to go through. 18 hours of preparation. Chuck and his cohorts get about 10 people. They demanded a hearing, and they got it. And these 10 people went in and testified against this resolution. Meanwhile, while that hearing was going on, I put together my sledgehammer action alert system. I call it sledgehammer because I realize that elected officials understand one of two things: money in their pocket to buy their vote, or a sledgehammer between the eyes to say, wake up, you idiot. I'm not going to give them any money, so I call my action alert system sledgehammer. And by the way, just as a side note, a few years ago, a friend of mine was in taking a course for the Republican Party to discuss new campaign tactics to get things passed and so forth. And they were in a course kind of discussing action alerts and that sort of thing. This is when it was kind of new. We were still doing it by fax and that sort of thing. In the middle of this course, the instructor holds up my sledgehammer. And he says, this is a prime example of what not to do if you want to influence legislators. You know why? Because sledgehammer is a bipartisan annoyer. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. If you do the wrong thing, I'm going to whack you between the eyes. He didn't like it because I used it on Republicans. That was his reasoning. And my friend was sitting there and he says, I happen to know that's an extremely effective alert system. So he defended me. So anyway, this alert, I put out my alert describing what was happening in Ohio. And usually we use this in Congress. And they're kind of jaded there. They get whacked every day by all kinds of alerts and people making phone calls and so forth. But when you go to more of a local level, they're not used to being targeted, especially when you get their name right in there, their name and their telephone number. You put it right in there, call this idiot and tell him this. That's what we do. And so I launched that at the same time this hearing's been taking place. As Chuck's troops are standing there yelling at him, one after the other, 10 of them, do you idiots know what you're doing? Do not do this. They're getting phone calls. No! 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 And the messengers are coming down from the offices going, we're getting phone calls, man. It was effective enough that day. They were going to go vote right then and there. It was taken off the calendar and it was not voted on that day. And essentially, that was the end of the battle. It took just a few hours to stop it. Now, the Senate, this was the House of Representatives in Ohio, the Senate was saying, we're going to do it anyway. We don't care what anybody thinks. We're going to do it. So you can't tell us what to do. So we launched another sledgehammer. And we named the names of the senators. And gee, it seemed to go by the wayside too, didn't it?
Their resolution was written so quickly that part of it was handwritten. Part of their, what they dropped was handwritten.
Unreal. Unreal.
And by the way, Bill Batchelder, I think, got 300 calls
did he?
That morning.
No. Well, what happened was I have never seen an issue. I've been involved in a lot of issues in my time. But this one, you talk about a grass fire. This just took off. Do you know who Brandon House is? Brandon House picked up on it. Brandon House has an organization. They do these worldview weekends. He has, I think, 75,000 people on his email alert system. Brandon picked it up and sent it out to his 75,000. There were others. I mean, we hit millions in a matter of hours of this thing going out. And the phone calls just started coming in. I started doing radio shows, fanning the fire and doing more. And what we did was we essentially poisoned the atmosphere for a constitutional convention so badly that other states didn't want to touch it. State of Virginia, there was a legislator there, a senator, who introduced it in Virginia. He didn't get a hearing. He got nothing. He didn't get a co-sponsor on it. Because, again, I turned the sledgehammer on it and told Virginians, stop this thing. We now have states that are working to issue resolutions to rescind the calls. There's 32 states that had called for it. They were starting, they want to rescind it. There are about 10 states now that want to do that. So we poisoned it so badly that they didn't dare come up with it again. Now, I know Chuck touched on some of this. Why are we so opposed to this? Well, I read you the Article 5. It has the call for this. All it says is that once 34 states do it, then it's up to Congress to do it. There are no rules how this thing would be put together. And, you know, we were lucky at the first Constitutional Convention. We had Ben Franklin and George Washington and these people there, and they put this document together. Today, we have Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and Barack Obama. And I have to look at it, and I'm thinking, what goes through your mind to think that you could go into a constitutional convention and have anything happen the way you want it to happen? They are working on such a misnomer, a misinformation, that they have the ability to control what's discussed there. The precedent of the first constitutional convention in 1787 was they went in and shut the doors, voted in secret, and nobody could talk about it. Nothing happened. No, nothing went outside. Nobody ever questioned it. And that's exactly what would happen this time. And this piece of garbage right here would be on the table. And how do you decide? Who picks the delegates to this thing? There's nothing to say that. Is it the House or the Senate? Is a special panel set up, some blue ribbon commission? You know how those work, blue ribbon commissions. We had the 9/11 commission. That worked really well. We had the Warren commission. That worked really well. A plebiscite, which is a vote of the people to pick candidates. Okay, who can vote? Who are the eligible voters? Are they only the taxpayers? Back in 1787, that's probably who would have been chosen, the taxpayers. But today, you know, we're talking about enfranchisement. We want to open our arms. We want to open the country up to anybody who comes in here, the potential, foreign nationals. We have all the illegals coming over the border. Well, here's a great opportunity to give them all a feeling of being part of the country. Help us create a new one. So let's give all them the vote. Is that what we'll do? And to be a delegate, what are the requirements? Just be a lawyer? You know, the best thing about communism is the first thing they do is shoot all the lawyers. But you would have, you know, a mix of people, college professors. Now, there's a group. College professors and lawyers and what is it Obama called himself?
Community organizers.
Yeah. We have community organizers doing it. We'll have ACORN set up the election process.
Probably
would be. And with these people as delegates, what do you think we're going to end up with? Is there any question? And the other thing, as I talked about last night with the Department of Homeland Security reports and the MEAC report from Missouri telling law enforcement that people who believe in the old Constitution, people who believe in limited government and voted for Ron Paul and believe in are opposed to illegal immigration or opposed to abortion and so forth are right-wing extremists. Well, I think, and as we put the criteria together who to be delegates to this thing, we're going to have to exclude extremists. We have to exclude them. That'll sure make it easy for them to pass this. So, these are the reasons why we fought so hard and continue to fight so hard to stop a constitutional convention, because it is utter, it's not even chaos, it is without doubt that the United States of America, as we know it, with the Constitution we have, will die. There's no question about it. The Constitution, even if it were discussed, if the current Constitution were discussed, you're talking about taking the Constitution and laying it out on an operating table, and then having all these bludgeons go in and whack things out of it, even if it got to that point of discussion. But, of course, it wouldn't be. We would just already have this to discuss, and that would be the end of it. This is an era where the Supreme Court of the United States, these guys have the easiest job ever created by anyone, any place. They get a lifelong job and a salary. They don't have to worry about pressure from anybody. They're there for life if they want to be. And all they have to do is look at the Constitution of the United States and look at this piece of legislation and say, does it match? How hard is that? That's all they've got to do. And yet, they're sitting there on the bench and they're saying, I don't know about that document. I'm looking at, the European Union has passed some very interesting laws over there. Zimbabwe's got an interesting way of handling government. They take all the property and starve all the people. And we could look at that. They're looking at foreign precedent to decide whether American law is constitutional or not, or allowable, because it's not constitutional, it's allowable. And that's what they're doing. And you take a look at this new monster that Barack Obama has just nominated for the Supreme Court, and there's no question with this woman what she will do with the Constitution. She's never read the Constitution, I'm pretty well convinced. Decided it was probably an evil book and going to stay away from it. She makes her decisions based on her experience in the ghetto. That's, yeah. So, these are the reasons why we got involved and fought so passionately to stop the Constitutional Convention. However, now, we've had such a wonderful thing taking place over the last several months. You've heard of the Tea Parties taking place, the protests against what's going on in government. There, Ron Paul has introduced a bill to audit the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve being the greatest evil of our government. It's not even part of the government. Controls the money and so forth. And we have End the Fed rallies taking place. I have been in places now where the chant just breaks out you know, end the Fed, end the Fed. And just say that and the whole place erupts and people start doing that. It's a great feeling. It's our people coming alive, the great sleeping giant awakening. And these things are happening. Well, now, as these tea parties are being held around the country and thousands of people are attending these things, there's always somebody who's looking at that and they're saying, how can I use that to my advantage? Well, now, some of these people, a lot of the people involved in the tea parties are very new to politics, and they don't quite know who to trust, and certain things sound good to them, and they can be swayed different ways. And there's a gentleman by the name of Randy Barnett, who is now heavily involved in the Tea Parties and with that movement, and he is putting forth the idea of calling a constitutional convention for all the same reasons I described before. You know, he's not a bad guy. At least I don't think he is. But his reasoning is, again, that we strengthen the thing. But he's got a different tactic here. He doesn't really want to have a constitutional convention. He just wants to have the threat of it. He somehow believes that if we start calling for a constitutional convention around the country, that Congress, rather than face the horror of a constitutional convention, will start passing amendments to the Constitution that we want, like a balanced budget amendment. That's his reasoning. We're going to use the threat of a constitutional convention as blackmail to get what we want in the Constitution. Meanwhile, these guys are going, yeah, let's have it. Come on. We're all going to agree here. Isn't this wonderful how America is coming together to agree, and that's what we're going to end up with. Here is an entire argument by these guys, not by Randy Barnett. This is written by a guy named Gerald Maglioka. Did you hear of him? Anyway, he's written this whole thing. It's part of the whole thing about why we should call a constitutional convention. This is how naive they are. He says in here, finally, there is a nuts and bolts benefit that comes from using Article 5 petitions, and that is that they represent a lure for voter turnout that political professionals of all stripes can use. So we're going to say we're going to have a constitutional convention, and that'll get the electorate all stirred up and talking and debating, and won't that be wonderful for democracy in America? That's his argument. And he says, giving people a chance to vote on constitutional issues that they feel strongly about is a terrific way to identify supporters, whether they are conservative or liberal, and get them to the polls. In part, that is due to the sheer magnitude of the issues. But another reason is that voters are not often asked for their views on these matters and are probably eager to give them. Has he never heard of the Gallup poll? We don't need to put the Constitution on an operating table so he can get a poll of where people stand. Now, the naivete that fools like this are operating from, first of all, he believes that the average American really supports the Constitution of the United States or has any clear idea of what it is. They don't. After about 25 years of brainwashing in the public education system, the average American voter hasn't got a clue of what the Constitution is, what their rights are, and what government's role should be. So this is the reason why we have been opposing this. And now this new, you talk about a worm that goes into the computer programs that, causes all the Trojan horses and all that kind of thing. That's what this is. It is moving into the best movement we've had in decades for the freedom movement, the Tea Parties and the Ron Paul operation and all that, and they're trying to get in there and put this little disease in it. So that's what we're trying to stop it. Now, There are some very good things happening, and I want to tell you this. One of the things in telling you about what we did to stop the Constitutional Convention in Ohio and how that's worked, there are people, rightfully so, who are very cynical, and they don't believe that we can win. They feel that it's just useless to even fight. And I understand why they feel that way. We have lost and lost and lost and lost. But on the other hand, over the last year or so, we have won a bunch of battles. We have stopped a bunch of things. Illegal immigration is one of the amnesty for illegal immigration. We still have not lost that battle. There are more coming. We haven't lost. Property rights is now starting to be understood by a lot of people. The Kelo decision that said that there are no property rights in this country, that woke a lot of people up. And now from the Ron Paul campaign, with the Tea Party and so forth, these things are changing. One of the interesting movements that's taking place, and has really been started by State Representative Charles Key from Oklahoma. He's kind of the godfather of the sovereignty movement. We talked 15 years ago among some of us that if we could just get the state legislatures to understand they have the power, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution is the most powerful amendment in the Constitution, and if they would exercise their power, it doesn't matter what the federal government does. They could just sit there all day long in Washington and pass one law after another. If it violates the 10th Amendment, then if the states understand that, they could reject it and ignore it. Charles Key has started this movement across the country, getting resolutions passed in state legislatures to recognize the 10th Amendment and get the states to stand up. Now, this is a beginning. It's a beginning of changing a mindset that's been there for over 100 years. That federal government should be more powerful than the states. And so a lot of people complain that these resolutions don't have any teeth to them. They don't make any difference. And I would, say they're probably right at this point, but if we're getting more state legislators and more state legislators to understand, then that'll change and it'll begin to have teeth. Where the rubber meets the road will be when the state finally refuses to take federal money and say, we don't need it, we're not going to do it, and then we can really get power in the states. But I want you to understand that there is a new activism taking place in this country, and I want you to get involved in it. When I was coming up, if I was younger, got involved in politics, I got involved in an organization called Young Americans for Freedom. And this is where I learned economics. It's where I learned about the Constitution. It's where I learned philosophy, political philosophy, and so forth. And we were very, very active. We were responsible, really, for getting Ronald Reagan elected president. And I know a lot of people say now, today, very disappointed in Reagan, and rightfully so, and so forth. But at the time, Ronald Reagan stood for everything we stand for. And he ran against Gerald Ford in 1976, and he lost. But the day he lost was the day the Reagan Revolution began. And 4 years later, he was elected president. During those 4 years, I don't know how many times I was at conferences where Ronald Reagan spoke, and we were young people on the chairs chanting for Reagan and so forth. And there was an electricity and activity in what we did. Last February, I was at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., where there was a side meeting, a little small room. I have good. Thank you. It was a special meeting for Ron Paul and a campaign for liberty. Over 1,000 people crowded into this room. And the same electricity, the same activism was there. And what I was most excited about was the creation of a new organization called Young Americans for Liberty. And I urge you to check this out. Look into them, and if you have the opportunity to join them, you will not only get a chance to work for what you believe in, you'll get a chance to work with other people and get to meet them, and you'll get a chance to learn things. So I urge you to join that. Now, last month, I had a very interesting experience along with a lot of these people. How many of you have heard of the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island? Anybody heard about this? Creature from Jekyll Island is a book written by a gentleman named G. Edward Griffin, and it is the story of the creation of the Federal Reserve. This was done in secret. Again, a plan was put in place before they ever started to move on it. And he talks in the beginning of the book about a secret train trip from New Jersey down to Jekyll Island in Georgia, where they had this meeting. In this train, there was a special train car. There was a senator who had his own railroad car, and people got on this car. They were not allowed to use last names. They could only use first names, they were telling everyone they were going to Jekyll Island to go hunting. And the train began to pull out of the station, and it stopped, and then it backed up, and it coupled onto another car. And now there were these two cars on the train, and they traveled in secret down to the Jekyll Island. Who was on the other car? Well, most people didn't know who they were at all. Turns out they were a group of people who represented 1/4 of the world's wealth. The Rothschilds, the Rockefellers were involved, and so forth. These were the bankers. These were the people who had the secret plan to take control of the American money system. And they went to Jekyll Island, and they met in rooms there, and they created the Federal Reserve. And then they set off to push it through Congress and get it done. Well, in the middle of May, I was invited to join a group of people to recreate that train ride. They started in New Jersey. I got on in Washington, D.C., and we traveled to Jekyll Island. And we went there to begin the process to undo what those guys had done in 1910. On that trip, I had the privilege to travel with G. Edward Griffin, who led the group, along with a gentleman named Bob Schultz, who was working to create a new Continental Congress. He wants to put not a constitutional convention, but a Congress of Americans from across the country, elected from every state, to sit down and discuss how we move forward and how we preserve this country. And there were about 30 of us that went on this trip, and we met there in Jekyll Island and discussed how the important part of what we were doing was we were organizing together. I knew like 3 people. I've been involved in this stuff for 40 years, and I knew 3 people on this trip. They were all new activists. They were Young Americans for Liberty. They were Ron Paul people. They were new, enthusiastic activists. And on the second day of the meeting, I was walking, and there's this old building. We were meeting in exactly the rooms where these guys had created the Federal Reserve. I was walking around this veranda of this hotel, and people were saying, "Did you see it? Did you see it?" And I looked up, and flying from the cupola on top of the building where the Federal Reserve was created was the "Don't Tread on Me" flag. With a rattlesnake. This is a symbol of our revolution. It's a symbol of today's new revolution. And we got it to fly up there. And what they did was the security guards at Jekyll Island joined in. And they started helping. And so, at the Capitol building, at the U.S. Capitol building, congressmen will get a flag, they'll run a flag up over the Capitol building, and then they'll bring it down, and then they'll give it to somebody. This flag flew over the Capitol. We were running up "Don't Tread on Me" flags. So people, they could give them out to people. This flew over Jekyll Island. So we did that. The most significant thing we did, and I want to leave you with this. In the room where the Federal Reserve was created, we joined together and signed a document. And it was done one by one. We were called up one by one. Video cameras running. And each of us signed this. And I want to tell you that I think that what this does is it creates a new era of continuing the revolution of 1776 and what the men did who signed the Declaration of Independence, that there is a new era, there's a new generation of Americans who believe the same thing. This is a document that we signed. We as American citizens assembled together on this auspicious day of May 21st, 2009, do hereby dedicate and consecrate our lives to uphold, preserve, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and the principles certified or contained therein. Are you trying to find it?
Yes.
We duly acknowledge the Declaration of Independence is the founding philosophy of our nation by which we abide. The Constitution of the United States of America is the governing body of law which protects the people of the land. The Bill of Rights is the order of the rights of free men. Through these, the greatest governing documents ever given to mankind, our founding fathers have made an eternal record of the will of the people to be free. We carry their sacred trust forward as we face the crisis of this time, knowing our allegiance to the principles contained therein and will be the resolve of our national distress. We reaffirm our devotion to the love of God and country, the cause of liberty, and the brotherhood of man, and to our union. We hereby affix our signatures to this document under the all-seeing eye of our Creator, humbly beseeching aid, comfort, illumination, and protection to fulfill America's destiny for generations yet to come. And we went up one by one and signed that document. It is, you know, a big document. Hopefully, someday in the future, as we continue to fight for freedom, that document will have as much significance as the Declaration of Independence did and continues to resound around the world. People around the world want freedom, and they look at America, and they look at our founding documents, and that is their hope. And as a Barack Obama goes around the world, what he thinks he's inspiring people around the world, they're actually in a lot of places looking at him with utter horror because they understand what he's doing. He is surrendering the greatest free nation on earth to totalitarianism. And today, the European Union, that is the symbol of the United Nations and the attempts to create a one-world government. Voters in the European Union countries have started electing conservatives to serve, which is a death knell for the European Union. Meanwhile, we have Barack Obama. One day, if we don't stay vigilant, if we don't fight these people and send them back, one day, liberty will wash up on our shores from somewhere else. It is our duty to defend, protect the Constitution of the United States and fight for freedom in America. So I urge you, get involved with Young Americans for Liberty and some of these issues. Learn about this. Take an active voice in it before you have no voice. And someday, we won't have to discuss these kind of things. We will have the United States of America as it should be and preserved. So, and again, if you, as Chuck said, if you can go to Freedom 21 in Oklahoma City, G. Edward Griffin will be there as our keynote speaker. Chuck Baldwin will be there. Information you've never heard anywhere before, you'll hear it there. So, again, I thank you so much for listening and participating and being here and doing things that other young people don't do around the country. You know more than any of them do. Take it and use it wisely and save this country. Thank you.
Now that was Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center. That's www.americanpolicy.com. Tom DeWeese is one of the stable of teachers that we keep at Camp American. And he comes back every, two or three years. And Tom always has something new and interesting and vital to the knowledge of those who want to develop and put into practice their Christian worldviews. This year, our stable of instructors includes myself. I'm teaching a class on the Electoral College. I think you would agree that a class on the Electoral College in a presidential election year isn't really a bad idea. And for those of you out there, I think there are maybe a rare few who took this class that I taught 4 years ago. Well, I always change them up. They're never exactly the same when I teach it the first time and when I teach it the second time. So just remember that. There's always new things in classes that I teach when we do repeats. Barry Sheets, who's teaching a class on a kind of a forgotten subject, but one that is very important to understanding our heritage of liberty in the United States, and that is the Kentucky and Virginia resolves and the spirit of 98. We have a Christian economist who has just the most incredibly rich background. He is studying to get a PhD in theology. He has a Juris Doctor. He has a PhD in economics. He has been a commercial airline pilot. This man has the most rich background you can imagine. His name is Dr. Sasha Vollacord, and he is currently the head of Business and Government Relations Department at Ohio Christian University, and he's going to be teaching on the basics of Christian economics and, of course, something on the current economic crisis. We're bringing in Dr. Michael Kaufman, who is an environmentalist, an environmental scientist, and he has recently written a book called Plundered, How Progressive Ideology is Destroying America. Dr. Kaufman has done extensive work on global warming and on Christian worldview issues. He's not a one-trick pony. He does any number of things. We are also bringing back Pastor David Whitney, who is the head instructor for the Institute on the Constitution, and you will have heard Barry and I talking about the classes that we teach in the Constitution, the Institute on the Constitution, and Pastor David Whitney is the head instructor for the group that put that class together. And let me tell you, he has a vast knowledge of the subjects involved. He's not just a pastor. He has a degree with honors from Rutgers University in history. He has theology degrees. He is, in fact, very brilliant in the areas of rights, the Constitution, government, history. He is just a completely well-rounded individual and well-qualified to teach these classes. He's teaching four classes: the importance of sacred oaths, counterfeit marriage, attempts to counterfeit marriage. He's teaching a class on the federal land grab and why every Christian should study the U.S. Constitution. So as you can see, we're kind of proud of our lineup. We'd like you to come up and check us out. The price is right. If you get in before the early bird deadline, which is near the end of May sometime, you can come to camp. Each student can come to camp for $250. If you are an adult, you can come as a volunteer, work in the kitchen. There are any number of things. We have room for adult staffers. We need people who can do things around the camp. So we always take volunteers, and volunteers always get a substantial tuition decrease. And when I say substantial, I mean substantial. It's large. Your kids come for a very small fraction of the normal price. Again, contact us at www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And please come in, sign up for class. Come up and be with us for a week, June 24th through 30th in Angola, Indiana at the Pokagon State Park. Again, check us out. Get details at www.campamerican.com. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. on next week. We have another fine lineup of programming coming up from the Institute for Principal Policy. We'll undoubtedly be running into things in the news that we just simply can't let pass without some form of analysis, as we always do. So I sign off today saying be with us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.